Ready to roll. Welcome to episode 55 of Running Into the Fog. It's really fun to jam on these with you, Eric. We've missed a few more of these episodes over the last couple of months because we've been busy with other things. Last Wednesday, we were on a work trip of sorts together out to the DC area. What'd you think about that?
Well, you know, it was my first real business trip in almost 3 years because I got it on an airplane and everything. And we shut down a karaoke bar, as I recall, and all sorts of other hijinks were had while we were on the road together for the first time in a while. I thought it was magnificent. Yeah. But I'm glad to be home, too. You know, I've kind of turned into this sort of a homebody during the pandemic. And I don't know if that's good or bad. My wife would probably tell you it's a good thing, but I bet your wife would too. But I'm super excited for our guest provocateur today. Do you want to do the honors?
I'd love to do the honors. We have Mr. Eric Garland with us today. And speaking of your wife, I believe she just showed up in the participant panel over here. Eric.
Hey, look Eric at Johnson. That. Hey, Tina, I'll try and speak nice about everything from this point on. Eric Garland, welcome today
to hey, Running guys. Into the Always good to be back. Good to see you.
Right.
You know, what's funny about Eric Garland is, Eric Garland, you showed up on this podcast many, many moons ago. In fact, it was a recording date of October 11th, 2021 for episode 27. This is before we went to the live stream format. So, you know, you were close to 30 episodes ago. What's happened in your life since then?
What's happened in my life, my world, my life? I'm home like everybody else in front of a computer, trying to make sense of the world. So nothing changed there. You know, the world, doing a lot of geopolitics and even counterintelligence stuff is my main bailiwick these days. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you've received the memo that we have changed the format since you were last on this particular podcast to first 30 minutes being open, pretty open family show, as we like to say. Alrighty. Second 30 minutes where we'll kind of close the bridge or close the channel to a certain extent, and it can be the non-family show there if we wish.
No stripteases, but, you know, we might get into some more, you know, intel behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, intel behind the scenes. So, Eric Johnson, when you think about your experience with Mr. Garland, yeah, what types of topics you want to start to jam on here in the opening half hour?
Well, you know, Eric, I always think of you as being both a macro futurist. You're sort of looking over the horizon to see what are the trends that are really driving the evolution of the world to come. Mm-hmm. But you're also really, really deep dive capable. So you can go a mile deep on any given topic and probably forget more than I'll ever learn about it. And I'll probably lose interest, frankly, before you'll be even halfway started. So I guess my first question is around, we got 1 week till the midterms next Tuesday. And we've got two realities, it seems like, in our world today. And one reality is telling you that, you know, right-wing QAnon attackers are breaking into the home of the person second in line to become the next president and doing all sorts of nefarious things. Then the other narrative is telling you that that was a totally different situation. There's one narrative telling you that Mr. Putin blew up the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines about a month ago, a little more than that. And then there's another narrative telling you that it was what was her name that was just prime minister of the UK? And she sent a text message to Anthony Blinken, Liz Truss. So we live in this world of two realities, it would seem, two narratives, if you will. And those narratives are pretty far apart. And I think, you know, as we continue to see polarization of the every person, almost used every man and, you know, was totally misogynist in doing so, the every person, folks like us and average citizens who have a skeptical eye about reality. I think, how do we navigate that? How do we interpret that? And can we expect that to kind of ease off a week from today, at least when maybe a week and a day from today?
Well, first of all, I would challenge the notion that there's two, because I think there's an almost innumerable number of realities that get set up, and it depends on what language you speak and what culture you come from. So there can be just a whole prism shattering of light there as to how people perceive events. I'd also say that in the intelligence world, I think, you know, the notion of my version of events isn't going to be your, you know, the average person's. I wouldn't have a job. This wouldn't be a job if you know if I already agreed with something you've already heard, and if you hire me to get to do a proper professional analysis of something, and it agrees with something that you can read online in a newspaper, or you know, you can get the same thing at a dinner party full of people that aren't informed and don't have a methodology, then why would anyone pay me? I mean, I'd have to go back to professional pancake flipping. So, you know, I'm very careful when we get into like world event stuff, to recognize the ceiling I'm going to run into on my pay grade. So when we talk about, you know, who really blew up the Nord Stream pipeline and who did that benefit? There's some things we can discuss about the latter part, like who would that benefit? We can do that analytically, but who did it is going to require military grade intelligence, which even then is not going to be correct, because all intelligence is wrong. It's just a question of how wrong or how it was incomplete. You can get much higher in your confidence interval by having more and more sources that corroborate, all the while knowing that you can have a bunch of, you know, depending on how you set the system up, you can have a bunch of things that corroborate without being aware of the bias, and that corroboration didn't actually help you. It just gave you multiple reduplicative, failed chunks of intelligence. So, when we come in for something like, well, do I have satellite imagery? Do I have a report from a Navy, our Navy? How about someone else's? You know, do we have partners in the region? How well can we trust that? That stuff is not going to be open, available, and discussable necessarily in the open source. It might be one of those things that is so important that it could be winnowed down to like 8 people that really know what happened. Depending on what the implications are. That one's really important because you're talking about, you know, a major piece of infrastructure was destroyed. Now, I don't know. Was that blown up in international waters? What is the status of infrastructure when it's in international waters as to off the coast?
That was a really good question. I want to say that was Danish water. I think it was Denmark's territory because of the place, the island next to which the thing happened. Mm-hmm. And I want to say it was Denmark and Sweden who then started the investigation initially. They're the ones who kind of were on scene right away. I think it was Danish water.
Now that sounds likely, so this could be considered an act of war. Well, so that makes a pretty, that's a big deal. Now, Denmark is part of NATO, right?
I don't know. I think so. Yeah,
it is. So that's a, if that was considered a strike on NATO territory, that would invoke Article 5, the Mutual Defense Pact. So who blew that up would really matter. So it's very interesting that this thing happens, but we don't have we're not invoking Article 5 here.
Yep.
If that was in considered Danish or Swedish territory, then you'd get into, well, who owned that if it's international waters, because you get cables that go across, like, telecommunications cables that go across the water, the floor of the ocean, huge long distances, well into international waters. And there are subs out there that can break into those things. And that's part of the covert balance of power that's going on at any one time. So when that thing happens, let's say you're interested in knowing that and you're not sitting at the Pentagon, you're not at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and you want to know about it. Well, that might be just one of life's mysteries, you know. Or if you're a professional analyst, you know, and you, you know, I would ask, what is the value in me knowing that thing to a higher degree of confidence interval? And how much time do I want to consecrate it to it? Because there's so many mysteries, you know, out there. How long will the McRib be around? You know,
too long. Too long.
Yeah, whatever is the answer, it's too long. At least in the case of the McRib.
I'm not one, but I've recently met a bunch of McRib partisans. So this is, you never know when you're going to find controversy. So for me, you know, in terms of analytics, you know, I have to know when to peace out and go, I don't know. You know, if I get read into that file or something, maybe we can talk. But then the question is, well, so what am I going to do about it?
Right.
Or what is the decision maker going to do about it if they ask me for my opinion? Now, if we want to go in terms of conjecture based on what we know. Now, I've been told, and I didn't even know where this was. I had read the headline. So let's say I'm going to start the deep dive and go, all right, well, so where was the thing? Now, you know, they were building out Nord Stream 2. Well, this was Nord Stream 1, right?
It was both of them.
Oh, really?
Okay. Both of them. Yep.
Okay. So we've now cut the line between of that energy flow between Russia and Europe, which is, you know, very interesting. And I think, you know, it'd be very plausible to consider that some NATO countries would want that to stop. But what if China got to buy a lot of the surplus that would be created by that not flowing west, but to make it flow south and southeast? They would have an interest. I'm not sure what Russia's interest would be in that, unless it was to garner sympathy, but that's not something they're going to be very good at right now. So
part of it's seasonal though too. And, you know, I've heard some analysts talk about the infrastructure in Russia, specifically Siberia, that would freeze over in the permafrost. And if they have to stop pumping, that those wells have to be re-drilled. That's not, and they don't have the technical acumen to do that again. They did in 1993 after the Soviet Union fell apart. We sent a bunch of companies over there to get access to those natural resources, but they don't have it in 2022 anymore. Those folks have died off. So is this a structural reduction of fossil fuels globally? And will they let that happen? Or here's something I learned a couple of weeks ago that I think you'll find interesting. Will India just buy it all using Emirati dirhams, which are pegged to the US dollar, which is what they're doing, by the way. So India continues to import a lot of Russian oil. It's just not dollar denominated anymore. And then, of course, that starts to call into question the nature.
It's not dollar denominated, or?
Well, it's they're buying it in Emirati dirhams. They've got so the original United Arab Emirates used Indian rupees as their national currency. So there's a tight sort of national banking relationship between UAE and India. And about 3 weeks ago, I was researching just randomly, like, where's all this oil going from Russia? India is buying it. They're just not buying it in US dollars. They're buying it in dirhams, which is pegged to the dollar. So obviously they've been appreciating. Oil's been getting cheaper for India because the dollar's been getting appreciated versus all the other currencies globally. But in that circumstance, obviously we end up having to evaluate, you know, who qui bono, I believe is the phrase, who benefits. Mm-hmm. Who benefits that Germany no longer has a negotiating position? In other words, it's an ultimatum for Germany. They've got to figure out some other way to stay warm this winter. And I heard recently that they've revised the forecast on our what was going to be very, very cold, very snowy winter. I heard recently isn't going to be that bad for some reason. And boy, my little brain remembered the key point my darling wife Tina picked up from your last time you were on the show, which was anything that makes you feel something before you think something is propagandist. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel something before I was able to think something. And suddenly I thought, wait a second, I'm getting fed a line of what Dad would have called horse hockey if he were on the family show.
And thank you for reminding me of that. Anything that propaganda is anything that makes you or wants you to feel something before you think something. And, you know, there's so many issues that just got brought up just from that one little event, right? We're talking about, you know, news to me that, you know, that you're able to buy U.S. oil in a currency other than the U.S. dollar.
Russian oil,
which I believe is sanctioned, but I'm not sure how much of it or
it's sanctioned in U.S. dollars.
Right. So now I'm gonna take a left turn here. Put that with the fact that Ford Motor Company, to my knowledge, just dismissed its research and development team for the combustion engine.
Oh. All done.
So we are, and we have been for some time, we are transitioning off of fleet fuels and fossil fuels for fleet, you know, that would be cars, trucks, airplanes at some point. We're going in this other direction. How soon do we get there? What's, you know, I look for sentinel events. So I see Ford Motor Company make a move like, whoa, it's like, we're not going to make new versions of that anymore. Some of that makes sense. If you look at the rise of Tesla and, you know, China's positioning around rare earth metal extraction and refinement, very clearly we've had a bipolar struggle for who's going to control the future of the electrical grid driven GDP economy. And that goes down, it's everything from manufacturing to driving, you know, a school bus. It's kind of everything that involves work and produces, you know, economic vitality and everything else. You know, we've been, you know, that's been the great game, is who's going to control that transition, us or them. And, you know, we had a treaty, we signed a treaty with three other countries. The United States has a new alliance known as the Quad Alliance, and that's the U.S., Australia, Japan, and India, where we have agreed to lock China out of the rare earth metals extraction and refinement. They're two slightly different businesses, you know, so that it benefits our defense needs in particular, our economic needs in particular, to their exclusion. It's pretty aggressive. Now, one might say that a lot of their stuff's been aggressive too, but, well, the pattern of engagement that we started with China 30 years ago has been, you know, morphing into, you know, adversarial issues to just a general adversarial nature. And that's, you know, and that's reflected in the geopolitical landscape and some of the, you know, very high level strategic moves the United States has made definitely in the last 2 years. The Quad started before Biden took office, which is very interesting, you know? So, yep. Yeah, if you believe everything was driven by one administration or another, it's funny when you start looking at some, you know, if you take a look at these strategic issues and you go, what date did that happen on? There was stuff that was going on in various agencies, certain prosecutions, weapons programs, intelligence agency maneuvers, that certainly did not track with Donald Trump is running the universe, and, you know, or any one actor is. There's been a lot of additional maneuvers in the world that you know, that sort of defied expectation. So if we're talking about narrative industrial complex, I think, you know, that what the narrative industrial complex wants to do is not just make you feel something, but bracket it so that you don't go looking outside. You've been told this is how we look at this issue. And, you know, we got to get to the bottom of who blew up Nord Stream. I don't think I need to. I mean, it might be if I had a different job or if I got assigned to a different job, maybe I'm really going to need to know that. But perhaps I need to know, why did that happen? Who did it affect? And does that take a, you know, does that take me into the universe of, wait a minute, okay, all this fossil fuel is going to these different places. I have to tell you, the most important thing you just said was, wait a minute, we broke the US dollar the rule that you only purchase or sell oil denominated in dollars. That there's been that threat, and there's people have wanted a post-dollar world, and they just ain't getting it. And so now I have the questions of like, okay, who are we taking action against India? Because as I just said, you know, we are in new treaties with India, and to my knowledge, Modi is still, you know, the leader of that country. He's still head of state. Yes, Narendra Modi.
Yes. However, it wasn't Modi who signed the Shanghai Pact alliance 4 or 5 years ago. And that's sort of been my perspective on this whole thing, you know, for the last couple of years, really far pre-pandemic, just pre-pandemic, when I started to familiarize myself with how much of humanity lives in these two different spheres. NATO is about 12.4% and falling, not as precipitously as many places in the rest of the world, like Russia or China. India is by no means falling in population, but India's presence alongside China, Russia, garden spots like North Korea and Iran, and garden, you know, spots, wonderful, you know, democratic countries like Venezuela, you know, Brazil is a signatory, South Africa, you know, places where corruption is completely unheard of, all are signed on to the Shanghai Pact. And that's about 40% of humanity is covered under that treaty umbrella. And they have an alternate banking system. It is not SWIFT. And the ability to transact outside of the US-controlled hegemonic banking system, my personal hypothesis, is what Putin was trying to create out of the sanctions situation. But again, just a hypothesis. I think a decoupling of those two spheres of influence is ultimately what he wanted. So that he could cut off Western Europe, frankly, even in spite of the fact that Western Europe is the lion's share of his income,
right,
economically.
That's the thing, you know, and there you have a rational actor working and not a madman or, you know,
right,
a crazy autocrat. Like, that's somebody making a chess move of like, oh, we pushed it too far here, and, you know, we're not going to get to float our yachts off of Monaco anymore. You know, you know, we're not going to get access to the world's great money laundering hubs, such as Luxembourg, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and the United States, the grand poobah of all money laundering havens, the U.S. with such garden spots as Wyoming, South Dakota, and Delaware. Well, we finally had an immune response to that, and it's like, it's not working out. And things have to be done. And there will be a future for these countries. What it looks like is very interesting. And, you know, when I see those, it's, you know, if you frame it up in, okay, who done it? Maybe Liz Truss did it. I mean, she didn't have time to do anything, did she? I mean, she was only Prime Minister of Britain 44 days longer than the three of us. And we weren't really trying.
You know? Here, here. So, Derek, before I pass the mic to you for 1 second, I want to point out that I've got one too many QR codes on the screen. Now, what are those QR codes, you're probably wondering? Well, the first one, the non-logoed one, is called a POAP, a proof of attendance protocol. You should scan it and keep it. Even if you don't know what a POAP is, or an NFT, or you don't have a crypto wallet yet, just go ahead and scan it, put your email address in, and reserve it so you can mint it later. The other one is how you join the actual bridge for this webinar. So those of you live streaming on social, scan that branded Unspeakable QR code. It'll take you to the registration page. You can come on in here into our intimate private little webinar panel. And if you're so inclined, you can join the panel and be an interlocutor of Mr. Garland. The first of which, by the way, is the courageous Mr. Terry Thiel, who, by the way, Eric, has joined us in the Council of Competitive Intelligence Fellows. And so welcoming another fellow into this bridge is always a joy and a pleasure. So Terry's going to be first. We got two more slots. Derek, I'll pass it to you.
Yeah, so Mr. Garland, you used to live in D.C. Is that right?
I still do, in my heart.
Okay.
And much of my brain.
You started the podcast today talking about multiple narratives and mm-hmm. multiple versions of what reality actually is. And mm-hmm. it's dependent upon how we think about certain scenarios, et cetera. Well, a long time ago, it feels like there was one version of the truth. And last week, Eric and I, my brother Eric and I and Terry, and thanks to Sarah Soriano, we got to tour a really cool museum where it feels like there might have been one version of the truth represented in most cases. So we went to the National Archives Museum. Have you been there?
Yeah, I have.
So I'm not a historian. I have an appreciation for history. And as I was driving my 11-year-old daughter to school today, mm-hmm. she started talking about how boring it is to study Thomas Edison and the advent of the light bulb in the late 1800s and what that meant to the Industrial Revolution. I said, well, you know, if you didn't have Thomas Edison way back then, you like to read by your bedside late at night, you might have a candle there. She said, well, I think that'd be fun. I said, okay, I'll give you that. But what if the candle fell over when you fell asleep without blowing it out and it burned the house down? She said, really kind of made her think, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe I made her feel something before she thought something. So maybe I was spreading propaganda.
Made her think something and then she felt something about it. Like, huh, candle, open flame. Huh.
Yep.
Yes.
I promise there's a question in here. And the question is this: if there's multiple versions of reality or the truth that exist out there in the world, what impact is there to institutions like museums, like what we went through last week? How does that change the landscape for those physical locations or even virtual locations where we expect to go for one version of the truth?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. So what is it? So you were at the National Archives? Mm-hmm. So you get to see some of the foundational documents like
Magna Carta and Declaration of Independence.
And the first time you've seen it, right?
Yes.
Yep. It's like, cool. It's like, that's a thing that guys, and I've read about these guys, that's the thing they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you watch the John Adams, miniseries, which is so wonderfully done and, quite accurate even. That's what they were working out, sweaty and drunk and in Philadelphia. So what is a museum? I think is a single aspirational narrative in beautiful, heavy construction building form. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what is not represented in the, please go there, it's a wonderful experience. The Smithsonian's just a national treasure. It's awesome. It's a bunch of beautiful buildings with singular narratives, mostly. Like, you know, we don't discuss a lot of narratives with any depth. Like, most people don't study the American Revolution. And they do enough in high school and maybe some in college, and aren't really history nerds and aren't in geopolitics. Because I tell you, you know, the more you get into the geopolitical landscape and you start seeing the relationships that form up, you know, like the fact that we have another probably more important alliance right now that supersedes NATO in some ways and even supersedes the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance is called AUKUS, AUKUS. That stands for Australia, United Kingdom, United States. And that we have these three countries are, you know, span the globe and are remnants of the British Empire. And we are, in some ways, still part of the British Empire. And that is not a, that. Now, there, right there, you depart from the National Archives. And you know, that, you know, that we are still benefiting from the fact that, you know, we were started by the British. Our system of law is British. Our language is British. With some but not that many alterations. By way of contrast, you guys know I'm from up by Quebec, and the version of French there is very often not intelligible with European French speakers, whereas Americans and Brits understand each other very well, with the exception of a few phrases like "knock me up in the morning," meaning "get me up early" in Britain, means something else here. But yeah. Other than that, we get, you know, we all understand each other. You know, when you go to the National Archives, you know, or anything about the Revolutionary War, what's not really represented is how many people were not partisans who wanted to secede from the British Empire. Either they had some apathy, they were of a different nationality and were already, you know, they might have been brought over in indentured servitude, or they might have been Dutchmen who were, you know, the remnants of Nieuwe Amsterdam and the Netherlands Empire that was established in New York, right? And who weren't as hot under the collar about some of this stuff, and that, you know, there was a mixed bag, and that a lot of people who lived in the colonies took off for Nova Scotia, and they were loyalists, and they left, and that it was not this monolithic, everybody had the same passion as John Adams in New England. And, you know, then there's all the people who were owned as property who didn't get a say in the thing. And many of them fought thinking they were going to get freedom out of the deal. And then they didn't. You know, that's not contained in that building. But is there any value to going as an eighth grader or as a 43rd grader, depending on how, you know, how old you are when you go? Is there any value in going and seeing, no, this thing really does exist. This is a piece of paper, and this is part of your heritage. And, you know, maybe that gets somebody interested. And the next thing, you know, they're scrolling on HBO Max and they come by the John Adams miniseries and they go, I want to see how this thing was written. Now we're opening the aperture. You might get as far as going, wait a minute, was Ben Franklin really an English intelligence agent the whole time? And Thomas Jefferson, did he have an affinity for the French, or was he being run as an agent of the French, both before and after the revolution? Those are questions that are more applicable and more interesting over time. And it's not, you know, so you got to kick the door open somehow. If nobody cares and nobody thinks it's relevant to anything, then they're unlikely to get any more curious to add additional facts in there. And because I can't tell you about, like, well, sometimes I get laid with the you know, the epithet conspiracy theorist. I'm like, that's conspiracy analyst, thank you very much. I'm a professional. I don't do this on the amateur level. But you know, conspiracy theory is, you know, which came up, do you guys know when that was invented as a term?
I believe our next provocateur who's joining the panel does, and I'm sorry to respond that way because
no.
We need to say goodbye to the live streamers. I'm sorry, guys, if you haven't converted by now, you're hopeless. So bye-bye for now, everybody on social. Join the bridge if you still can.